how a band of small, naked, hairless, fangless, clawless, hornless primates used a few sticks and stones and each other to change the world. This is In the Moment, the podcast version. We're always fascinated by the creative process on this program, and this week we turn to evolution for answers. Augustine Fuentes is the author of a new book called The Creative Spark: How Imagination Made Humans Exceptional. South Dakota high school students transcend the stage at Poetry Out Loud, plus N.W. Engvers and the music of life and death. Let's kick things off with Augustine Fuentes. Tell us what some of the first signs of human creativity are when we go back, turn back the clock a bit.
A bit. So let's go back 2 million years.
All right,
the beginning
start there.
Of our lineage. So let's go back then, and what we see is our ancestors are a group of fairly small, naked, hairless, fangless, clawless, hornless primates, and all they have are some sticks and stones and each other. And through a lot of collaborative creativity, they come up with ways to sort of protect themselves from all the things trying to eat them and to slowly, over 2 million years, change the world and themselves in really substantial ways. One great example is stone tools. Most people aren't impressed by sort of sharp rocks, but nothing else on this planet has ever seen inside a stone another tool, a shape, and been able to work together to create that. So from that 2 million years ago and those incredible early stone tools, we see just big trajectory of change, of innovation, lots of failure, lots of successes, and today we have iPhones and 747 airplanes.
How does that begin? Do we have any way of knowing what sort of sparks that sort of looking at a stone and saying, I see a shape inside of it? There's no way of knowing, is there?
Well, we know that other primates, for example, some apes, chimpanzees, and some capuchin monkeys in Central America, they'll use stones. Even some birds will use stones, just unmodified, to crack nuts or to break things open. But the transition from just taking a rock about finding one the right size to hit something with and seeing inside that rock a shape that could be changed, altered, and developed into a much more efficient and effective tool is something that happened. We know that the earliest stone tools predate even our lineage. They're about 3 million years old, of things that we probably our ancestors, but we're not 100% sure. But we know that by the time our direct ancestors, our own genus, shows up in the fossil record, tools are getting more complicated, more common, and they just continue to do so through today.
So if they're more common, that means that technology, if you were, sort of is spreading. Is there a communication at that point? How is that being communicated from one of us to another?
Well, that's what's so amazing, and that's part of this early collaborative creativity. We don't know. We know they didn't have language. They had brains half the size of ours, and there's no evidence they had complex sort of language or skills, but they're finding rocks, because not all rocks work for stone tools. You got to find the right rocks. You got to go repeatedly back to get those rocks. You got to organize, to collaborate, to carry those rocks and make the stone tools. And making stone tools is very loud, and there's a bunch of large predators in the environment, so you have to figure out when and where you do it. Then you have to teach one another to do it. There's great evidence that multiple individuals made these tools, and you have to sort of shape it. And so we think what happened was a mixture of sort of what we call apprentice learning, learning through observation, through sort of copying, and sort of through the transmission of information, not quite language, but definitely more than we see in most other animals.
What kind of evidence does the fossil record show then of collaboration?
Well, I think one of the most important ones are our babies. Human infants are incredibly dependent, right? They're born completely, well, I don't mean to knock babies, but useless in the sense that they need huge investment. They can't get up and run. Most animals, you know, the baby comes out and they can run in a few hours. Even those that keep them in nests, they're able to fend for themselves to a certain extent. But human infants take years, if not decades, to fully mature. And we can see as much as 1.5 million or 1.7 million years ago, we can see sort of the initial growth stages that start to look like our modern growth stages showing up, and the brain's getting bigger. And we know that that could not have happened if there wasn't intensive collaboration in the caretaking of young. That saying, it takes a village to raise a child, that goes deep into our history, and it's extremely true.
And I have to say, as I was reading this book, I found that extremely validating as a parent. It was like, oh, I'm not doing it wrong. It really is that.
This is something that's really important that we know, and this is another reason why all of this data, all of these scientific studies, they shouldn't stay in the university. They need to be made public. They need to get out there. The whole idea that a single human being, just a mom or just a mom and dad, are expected to do all the child rearing by themselves, that's a little crazy. All of our data from our biology and the fossil and archaeological evidence suggests that human children need a lot of input, a lot of support, and mom and dad need huge assistance from others. Yeah. We can do it, but that's not the way we've done it, and that's not the way we've led to our success. It is a collaborative effort.
So let's go back a little bit again and just talk about are we competing with, from an evolutionary perspective, are we competing with other species who are developing the same kinds of creativity and sort of outwitting them? Or is it just us, you know, from our particular branch that has figured this out?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you want to call other species. Over the last 2 million years, there's been a bunch of human-like things. They've interbred. We know that from the genetic data. Many populations show up and disappear over time. Today, Homo sapiens sapiens, you and I, us, we are the last of the entire lineage of human-like things living. So there's something particularly interesting about us. How much all of these other ones were part of us? Well, we know some of their genes are still in our bodies. But we know that there was a lot of experimentation and innovation. And so we can argue, as many people had, that it was all about competition, right? Us versus the Neanderthals, right? Or something like that. But the evidence doesn't really suggest that necessarily. Obviously, groups fought in the past, individuals fought, but it looks much more like it was innovation, experimentation, creativity, with lots and lots of failures and a few really critical successes that enabled our ancestors to sort of create a landscape that allowed us to flourish the way we do. I mean, there are 7.5 billion humans. We're incredibly successful.
So during your research, did anything surprise you?
A lot of things surprise me. I'll give you two things. One is we are very arrogant humans. We think we're, you know, really special, and we are in many ways, but not always in the ways we thought. I was doing research with my collaborators at National Geographic CritterCam, and we put some HD, some really good cameras, on monkeys in Gibraltar, the southern tip of Spain. So they collected data for us. We wanted to see what they were doing and where they were looking. And this one female sat up on this rock looking across the Strait of Gibraltar to Africa. It's beautiful, you know, across the straits, whales out there and mountains in the distance. It's absolutely gorgeous. And then she shifted slightly and reframed what was probably the most beautiful picture any of us had seen. It took our breath away. And she just sat there for 5 or 6 minutes staring at it. Huh. Aesthetic beauty? I don't know why. But other animals can experience some of those things that we do. So that impressed me and humbled me a little bit as a human. But what I think is really amazing, what's really taught me a lesson, is how unbelievably resilient humans are in the face of incredible adversity. We have the capacity to work together, to create, to collaborate, and to succeed in cases when I think we're doomed and we're not. And that gives me hope.
So creativity manifests itself in so many different ways, and I want to talk for a minute about how this sort of expression, the creative expression that we might consider art, storytelling, music. What's the evolutionary history of that for humans?
Well, so there's this amazing record of unbelievable art. Now, once we get into the last 30, 40,000 years, I know for most people that's a long time, but from an evolutionary perspective, that's not long. We see cave art, we see incredible figurines, we see carvings, but you can go back much deeper. 80 to 100,000 years ago in southern Africa, our ancestors were carving incredible patterns onto eggshells and onto bones. As much as 200, 300,000 years ago, they were painting their bodies with pigments and dancing around fires. Maybe even older than that, they were carving into clam shells and maybe even making little sort of rock figures that looked like humans. So deep in our history is this need, this desire, this capacity to shape the world, to represent something. Most people call it symbol. We can debate that. But art, the idea of aesthetic beauty and expression, is really deep in our lineage. And I think it's really important. Kids do art all the time. They do all sorts of imaginative expressions. And for some reason, as adults, we stop. I think we shouldn't. I think we should keep it up.
What shows up first in the record? Creative expression, artistic expression that we might recognize as such, or large-scale violence and war?
Large-scale violence is our most recent creation of that list.
Really?
There's really, really good evidence. Now, there's a lot of argument. Folks like Steven Pinker and others have argued that in the past we were really violent and aggressive, but that's not true. We have a lot of data over the last 2 million years, and we know not that our ancestors ran holding hands through the daisies all the time. They hit each other over the head, you know, frequently sometimes, but they didn't do it in big, organized, lethal ways. It isn't until the last maybe 8,000 to 15,000 years that we see evidence of anything we could call lethal, organized intergroup violence, otherwise known as warfare. Mm-hmm. But that coincides with the time when we started settling down, doing agriculture, making villages, towns, cities, economies, politics. Warfare ratchets up as our societies become larger, more complex, and more unequal. As there are more goodies to fight over and less control over those goodies, warfare starts to show up. So warfare is a recent creation. It's part of our creativity. And it's not going anywhere, but it's not as deep or ubiquitous as we think in our history.
It's not really encoded into who we are necessarily either.
No, it is not.
So does that mean we can
most people say that. Well,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Does that mean we can get rid of it? We can eliminate it?
No.
Why not?
Nope. I really don't think so. I mean, inequality is here to stay, and that's going to give a kind of violence. But we can manage how inequality is played out. We can do a much better job of structuring societies so the impetus, the desire, and the need for warfare is not there. We're not going to get rid of injustice and inequality, but we can really reduce it and manage it in much better ways. We know how to avoid war. We can do it pretty clearly. We also know how to make war. And so it's the choice, right, and the actions we have to take.
So is the person who sort of win is the wrong word, but overcomes the conflict, maybe is that the group of people who collaborate the best, and that could be used for good or for what we would call evil?
Yes, absolutely. So our creative, collaborative, imaginative capacity is for better and for worse the secret to our success. But we need to sort of think about how we want to manage that. What do we want to do? So, for example, in warfare, okay, it's not the most aggressive or violent army that wins. It's the better cooperators, the more creative, the more collaborative. But at the same time, we always talk about war and terrorism and violence. But the vast majority of the 7.5 billion people on this planet are not involved in those things on a day-to-day basis at all. Mm. A very, very small percentage are. Most people are getting along, working together to solve problems, hanging out, doing art, creating meals, standing in lines. We are creative every day in many, many ways, and we ignore that. We've got to step away from the 27-hour news cycle and recognize what we actually do and not let fear drive our understanding of humanity.
And, Augustine, I'm wondering about this notion of gender and gender on a different spectrum, gender fluidity that we're sort of dealing with in our society today, it seems. How does that fit into our evolution, male, female?
Yeah, so this is a great area, and an area where the public just doesn't have much access to the really incredible data out there. Let's put it this way, right? There are big differences biologically between males and females, but there are way more similarities. There are big differences between the genders, male and female or masculine and feminine, but way more overlap. We don't usually think about it that way. We tend to think men are from Mars and women are from Venus. Well, the data from our biology, our physiology, and our behavior refute that, and yet we continue to believe it. If we look into the past, we could ask, well, if the gender roles of today are really this deep evolutionary process, we'll find evidence for it in the past. And guess what? We don't. It's not that there wasn't gender in the deep past. It's just that it wasn't the same as it is today. The gender roles that we see today, the sort of males in the public, political, economic sphere, and females in the house, domestic sphere, that is extremely recent. For example, we talked about stone tools earlier. Whenever I give a lecture in public or in a classroom and I hold up an old stone tool, maybe a million years old, and I ask, a picture who made this? All the students or all the audience picture a guy. There is no evidence, not one piece of evidence, that males or females were more likely the stone tool makers.
Interesting.
But yet we impose our gender on the past. Actually, we don't know who did all the art, because it's that same way, except a recent study of all these really cool cave handprints, art handprints over the last 30 or 40,000 years. A recent study shows that 70% of them were done by women, not men. That's not the way we think of it either. So gender was much more complicated in the past. That tells us a lot, because our gender issues today are really because we've tried in the last few centuries to narrow the sort of window of sexuality and gender expression. If we know anything about human sexuality, it's complicated and messy, and that's never going away. The more we try to narrow it, the more we recognize how diverse it is. But I think that's changing. I think young folks today are much more open to diverse gender and sexualities, and I think in 20 years, no one's going to be worrying about which bathroom someone uses.
All right, we got to talk about dogs, because I'm a dog lover, and they play pretty prominently in our history. Why are we so close to our canine partners?
Well, 20 to 30,000 years ago, humans and wolves started getting along. They started a relationship which has produced humans and dogs today. We have co-evolved, and this is one thing that's really important. There's great evidence that we domesticated dogs, but they domesticated us too. If you look across the planet, most, not all, but most societies, humans and our canine companions share space, share their lives, share emotional attachments. We even share the ability to manipulate each other's hormones. And anyone who owns a dog knows that, when you look at your dog in the eye, or that kind of emotional and physiological response. We've co-evolved to read each other's moods, to comfort one another, to work together. And that's really incredible for two so different species. We're tightly woven together. I think if an anthropologist from Mars came down to the planet Earth and looked at all the relationship between different species, she would definitely choose humans and dogs as one of the most interesting ones to study.
All right, Agustin Fuentes, the end of this book, a good section of this book, if you're thinking about purchasing it, I highly recommend it today. Lots of research. And then it has this really compelling coda at the end called The Beat of Your Creative Life, where it sort of breaks everything down. If you just picked it up and read the coda, I think you'd have a really good day. Some of the highlights from that, where we just have a couple minutes left. What do you want to hit from that? The first steps in the human dance. Let's just talk about the idea of embracing diversity and seeing failure as part of the journey.
Absolutely. One of the things that's most important is, if you look across the last 2 million years of our history, most things fail. Most populations go extinct. Most of our creative attempts have been failures. That's the way it works. Talk to any star athlete, performer, politician, instructor, whatever, and ask if you had more failures or more successes in your life. They're going to tell you failures. I think we're afraid of failure, and we don't understand that the capacity to fail and to learn from failures is the number one way to get more creative and to get more successful. There's deep evidence for that. I think we need to recognize that, because in our society, we sort of penalize failure and think it's a bad thing. It's part of the learning process. Diversity is the other thing. We suffer when we don't have diversity, when we don't have lots of different kinds of inputs, lots of ways to think, lots of ways to be human, and there are many successful ways to do it. We cut down our imagination. We limit the capacities of our incredible brains to do amazing things in our own bodies and with others. And so diversity is actually fodder. It's information. It's like nutrition for the creative imagination. So if we put those two things together, the idea that failure is not bad, it's actually part of the process, and the idea that diversity actually benefits us, those two things, I think, are a good starting point for when we think about what we want in a society.
And here's one of my favorite lines from the coda. Reading is one of humanity's greatest and most distinctive skills. As a great book lover, this is a science book that makes science accessible to me, but also challenges me and makes me want to learn more. And in the coda, you really have this sort of call to say, you know, seek out the science. It is within your reach. Why is that so important to you, that everybody sort of seeks out that information and that knowledge and grows from the place where they are to a greater level of understanding?
Because that is what the capacity of the creative spark provides us with. And I think a lot of people cut themselves down and actually don't give themselves credit for being able to understand complex information, complex science on the one hand. But on the other hand, the people who do science, like myself and others, we're at fault for not delivering this information in ways that are accessible outside the walls of the university or the peer-reviewed science journals. Mm-hmm. So I think people need to make more of an effort to try to educate themselves, to get information. Knowledge is power. And scientists also have the moral and ethical responsibility to sort of put this awesome information out into the world so people can access it. The more we know, the more we have the opportunity to think through it, to create, to imagine, and to go, to use that incredible human capacity, to go from what is to what we think might be.
The state finals of the South Dakota Poetry Out Loud competition brought students from across South Dakota to share memorized poetry and original works. Today, we hear just a few of those poets. Here's Liz, Rosie, and Jane.
El Olvido by Judith Ortiz Cofer. It is a dangerous thing to forget the climate of your birthplace. To choke out the voices of dead relatives when in dreams they call you by your secret name. It is dangerous to spurn the clothes you were born to wear for the sake of fashion. Dangerous to use weapons and sharp instruments you are not familiar with. Dangerous to disdain the plaster saints before which your mother kneels, praying with embarrassing fervor that you survive in the place you have chosen to live. Bare, cold room with no pictures on the walls. A forgetting place where she fears you will die of loneliness and exposure. Jesús, María y José, she says. El olvido is a dangerous thing.
Transgender. This is about a person being transgender in a society that only believes in being normal. First of all, what is normal? Second of all, the word itself sounds sickening. I think I might regurgitate my lunch. They were born female, but they identify as male. Society calls them confused, tranny, or misshapen. For 16 years, they have been living to be conformed, to dress, act, look, and be a girl. 2 years, starting March 2014, they have been labeled confused, tomboy, dyke. They began to believe they were a boy. The mirror always lied to them, showing them the body of a female, looking down at a chest that doesn't belong to them, seeing genitals that make them feel out of place. They may not be a boy physically, but they are mentally, spiritually, and emotionally male. Go ahead, call us a dyke. Call them confused, tomboy, Superman, Batman. Call them whatever you want, but their name is Elliot Poy. They know who they are. Do you?
Very Large Moth by Craig Arnold, after DHL. Your first thought when the light snaps on and the black wings clatter about the kitchen is a bat. The clear part of your mind considers rabies. The other part does not consider, knows only to startle and cower away from the slap of its wings. Though it is soon clearly not a bat, but a moth, and harmless. Still, you are shy of it. It clings to the hood of the stove, not black, but brown. Its orange eyes sparkle like televisions. Its leg joints are large enough to count. How could you kill it? Where would you hide the body? A creature so solid must have room for a soul. And if this is so, why not in a creature half its size, or half its size again, and so on down to the ants? Clearly, it must be saved. Caught in a shopping bag and rushed to the front door, afraid to crush it, feeling the plastic rattle, loosened into the night air, it batters the porch light, throwing fitful shadows around the landing. That was a really big moth, is all you can say to the doorman who has watched your whole performance with a smile. The half compassion and half horror we feel for the creatures we want not to hurt and prefer not to touch.
W. Engbers writes songs that wrestle with ideas of life and death. He stopped by the SDPB studios to talk about the creative process and to share his music.
I wrote this song. This song is very influenced by South Dakota, so it's kind of cool as a South Dakota public radio. But I wrote this out kind of by Midland, South Dakota, in a cemetery by an abandoned church. But I lost three grandfather figures last year, all in the same year, both of my grandfathers and my wife's grandfather. Mm-hmm. And this song kind of came out of that. I don't know if there's many songs about pallbearers, but this one is. And just know that it came out of that. And I think it's kind of reflecting, as I was carrying one of my grandfathers to the grave, I kind of came up with this idea, bearers.
We carry you, your skin and bones in blackish suit, box made of ash. We'll soon be filled with ashes too. So is that you, or did you float out past the moon? And may I ask if what you thought was true? From death to seed to life to bloom. There's nothing new under the sun, we're just like you. Blood of your blood, what's been will be, what's done will do. Don't get a say. I wonder who will carry me when I am through. Will he have his mama's eyes, his daddy's nose, or look just like you? The more I live, the more I die, the more I die, I wanna live. It's clear to me that I don't get a say. And the more I see, the more I find, the point is never to arrive, but just to know we're headed the right way.
Music from N.W. Engbers. You can hear full episodes of In the Moment on SDPB Radio Monday through Friday, 11 a.m. Central Time, 10 Mountain. From all of us at South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.